My name's Fred. I'm an alcoholic and addict.
Hey, Fred.
And glad to be here. I don't think I've spoken about anything for 10 minutes many times, which means I usually speak longer. So if I speak too long, let me know. I have a milestone coming up, the 25th of October, 1980 is when I got sober, and I was 19 years old. It's weird because usually around those, usually I feel a lot of mortality around my anniversary or whatever. I feel like, you know, I'm going to fuck up, I'm going to drink, get high, something like that, and it usually never happens because I do my best to apply my steps. And I went through a program. It was different. It was a drug rehab. So weirdly, our program is 7 steps. They're not 12. And I was an adolescent, or, well, I was 19 years old when I came in. I had a pretty normal upbringing, you know, kind of a 60s, child of the 60s, Beaver Cleaver type, you know, Methodist upbringing mixed in with copious amounts of LSD and charismatic Christianity, people speaking in tongues and, you know, like freaky stuff like that, Christian indoctrination, Campus Crusade for Christ. We used to go there and like basically felt like I was kind of brainwashed about the rapture and things like that, which thankfully now my spiritual relationship's a little different than that. I don't feel super guilty all the time and like always beat myself up about like not living up to this expectation. But so I grew up in the 60s and 70s. I got sober after I was 19. You know, some of you guys have heard my story before. I almost went to prison for drug dealing. That was kind of a long culmination of, you know, LSD, and that's a big part of my story. Drinking, big part of my story. I always think about sitting in this room, sitting on the ladder beside this house at a party, throwing up. And, you know, that everybody said, I'm never going to do that again if I get better. And I did, you know, drink. I blacked out several times. One time, I don't even know how I got there. I was in the boat in the middle of a lake at a party. And do not know how I got there. Another time, I was underneath a street light. Don't know how I got there out in front of my house. I had a friend that used to have a rat, and she would put that on our shoulders when we were, like, tripping on LSD. And that was really fun. But, yeah, I had kind of an unusual life. And, you know, I really didn't think I had a problem at all. You know, I just thought I, like, had mental problems or something like that. Never wanted to admit that I had a problem with alcohol or drugs. So my family, when I was going to, not jail, but when I was going to court, they basically told me, okay, you can either get sober or you can get court ordered to a drug rehab, or we're not going to have anything to do with you anymore. So, you know, I just kind of thought, okay, well, I'll give that a try. And then I thought, going into the program, that they were going to magically, like, you know, wave this magic wand around my head and I wouldn't drink or do drugs anymore. And so the program that I was in, it was like a lot of people, you know, health and human resources or whatever, they thought it was a cult. You know, the people were brainwashed there. And it was really weird. It was in Florida, and, you know, it was kind of Christian based, but you know, when I first sat down in the front row, the first night that I came in, I looked up at the 12 steps and they made sense to me, like I had read them before or something. Weirdly, you know, they made sense to me partly because I was Christian, and you know, I had like a spiritual background already. And You know, so I thought, well, I'll give this a try. If it doesn't work, you know, no big deal. And then here I am, like almost 39 years later. And it's been one of the best things I've ever done for myself. You know, the what it says in the big book about a life beyond our wildest dreams. I don't know if it's that incredible. I mean, it's pretty good, but I have a lot of, you know, peace and serenity. I sit in my backyard. I live not too far from here. I sit in my backyard in a hammock and just kind of trip out on nature and feel really good. You know, not really tripping out about the fact that I don't drink, because I like the fact that I don't, you know. I go through Trader Joe's all the time. I go to bars. I hang out with people that drink. It really doesn't bother me, but I do definitely know my first step. And, you know, that's like the most important thing to me. Well, there it is over there. I was like, wait, what? Yeah, and then, you know, I like to say sometimes my name, and then I admit I'm powerless over drugs and alcohol, and, you know, try to give something in my story more about the steps than, you know, drunkalog or whatever, so I can, you know, let somebody else have something from what I have to say about how, you know, it's worked in my life and helped me change myself. I mean, I always talk about how amazing it is, you know, just like thinking about the steps in my head and like problems that I might have at work or with a person or whatever. You know, the serenity prayer. It's amazing. These people came up with it, you know, and like thousands and millions of lives later, it's helped us all, you know, like get ourselves together. And it's pretty great. You know, I like to think of myself as an AA cheerleader, but, you know, it's helped me a lot, and I'm really, really appreciative of that. Before I almost went to jail, I was trying to become a commercial diver. I thought I would, you know, get some cocaine and sell it for a profit, and you know how that works. Didn't work. I thought I was going to finance my school with that. That didn't happen. I ended up almost going to jail and then going through drug rehab. And then after I did do that, I did achieve that goal. You know, I went to college, went through commercial diving, and, you know, I'm still doing that. I work with the Pile Drivers Union. I'm on the executive board over there. Try to mentor young people and help get them in the union, because that's another thing that I'm really proud of, that I'm a part of. So anyway, I think that's about it. Anyway, thanks a lot for letting me share.
Hi, I'm Patrick. I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict.
Hey, Patrick.
Yeah. I found out I was going to do this at, 6:30. And, I was really spaced out. You know, I've been doing something else, and I wasn't prepared to do it, and so I wanted to say no. I said no, I wanted to say no, I can't do it. So I went inside myself mentally to find the box that says no to sharing an AA meeting, and it wasn't fucking there. That wasn't internally an option for me, which goes to show that I have definitely been acculturated to AA, you know what I mean? It was like I thought to myself, I could say no. Nah, fuck that. I don't like what's down that path. So anyway, that's basically what happened. And but I'm kind of nervous because I'm trying like hell to remember my story. And it's kind of a little, the whole thing's a little dim to me right now. So I've just been going back down the path. The reason is because I got sober in 83 when I was 21. So a lot of that stuff's, you know, a pretty long time ago now. And I like to say, you know, I'm not sober now because of the drinking that I did. I'm sober now because of the drinking that I would be doing today if I wasn't in AA. So I don't spend an enormous amount of time thinking about that. But I have told my story a number of times and whatnot, but now I've got to stretch it out stretch that shit out so I can go into some detail. So anyway, I'm going to say what it was like, what happened, what it's like now, and then I'm theoretically going to share some experience, strength, and hope. And perhaps I'll be slightly entertaining at certain points of it. Anyway, so I am... I can't really tell my story without telling my father's story at all. I mean, it's extremely intertwined. He had a massive, out-of-proportion impact on my life. And so he was alcoholic, and he got sober, and he got 35 years, and he died at the age of 75. And I'm sober because he got sober. Like you see every so often, some guy or woman gets sober because of one of their parents is sober. Well, that was me. And I would have followed, if he died of alcoholism, I would have died of alcoholism. I would follow him to hell, but I wasn't going to follow him to hell unless he went to fucking hell. And he didn't go. He stopped, you know, and he was just living. And I thought, hey, wait a minute now, hold on a second. This isn't correct. I don't think I would have gotten sober if he hadn't gotten sober with the legacy of him dying of alcoholism. But that's not what happened. I now have two nieces that are sober. So anyway, that's how that goes. My brother is sober. So what happened with him was he had a bad kind of a story. His dad was a career soldier in World War II, and kind of a certain kind of a serial killer. He was very successful in the war. But he was a lifer in the war because he got out of the army and then he got into a roofing business and he threw a guy off a roof, we're told. We never find out what happened to the guy, and the judge said, you can go back in the army or you can go to jail. And he spent the rest of his career in the army. And then I guess he hooked up with a woman who was a prostitute, I guess. My father used to describe her as a fallen woman, and that was my grandmother. And then my dad went to an orphanage, and then apparently if you were a small child in an orphanage in those days, there were certain predictable things that you could expect. And then he got out of there and kind of got his shit together, went to a nice Christian school, did well in philosophy. And he was drinking heavily, and he got into Cal. And he was one of those people that they were doing this at Cal. They can still do this, where they say to a graduate student, you failed, and then the professor publishes the grad student's papers under their own name. They did that to my dad, and then he started drinking a lot more heavily. So about that time, I was about 6 years old, and my father was violent with children, to say the least. And then one day I ran afoul of him. I did something stupid. I told a lie to my mom about something that had happened while he could overhear me. And so he tossed me into the corner of a cabinet, and it fractured my skull. Hit me right there and fractured my skull, which was not a problem. But then he kept hitting me in the head. That led to a particularly bad period in my childhood, as parts of my brain were just broken and shut down. And I could feel them breaking and shutting them down. And I was very engaged in this process. And it was super fucking painful. And then the whole time he was sharing his worst alcoholic fears with me as parenting information. He was telling me these things like, if you ever relax for a second, they'll be on you like dogs. And he told me, at the heart of every human relationship is something so disgusting you won't even be able to look at it. Right, and that kind of thing. He was telling me that kind of thing, and I was absorbing it. I was a dutiful child, trying to do my best, trying to cooperate with him in the process of killing me. And so that didn't go very well. That wasn't too good. And then, so my mom threw him out, and then and then she went into a deep depression, and then there was like no mom. There was like no mom for a couple years. And that was also extraordinarily difficult. You can have three types of attachment to your mom: secure, mixed, and insecure. My attachment to my mom, extremely insecure. And so that's what happened there. So I was a fucked up individual. And then when I was about, I guess about 10, I started smoking pot. And there was, I underwent a complete and total transformation, which is that I became entirely oriented towards marijuana. I didn't care. I mean, that was the sole reason for my existence. And it happened, I think, within 2 or 3 seconds of the first hit I had. And the exact same thing happened with alcohol. There was never any period of like, you know, I don't know, whatever. I'm not really sure what there wasn't a period of, because I never had that period. Some people drink successfully or whatever. Whatever successfully means, they could control when and how much they drank. Like now, today, I think to myself, maybe I'm not an alcoholic anymore. Maybe I could drink. You know, often happens to me in meetings, and I'll spend half the meeting obsessing about whether or not I can fucking drink. And it comes down to, if I could control when I drank, or if I could control how much I drank, I would fucking drink. But I can't. I can't control either one of those things. And that's totally untenable. You know, you just can't live like that. There's just no way of doing that and living inside. So anyway, that's what happened along those lines. And so then, by the time I was 19, I was trying to control my drinking. And I was trying to control my drinking partly because people around me were starting to use heroin. And, you know, and it was inevitable that I was going to use heroin because that's how the fucking thing goes. And I'd been warned about that as being a particularly dark path to go down. And so I didn't want to do that. And so I was trying to just sort of control it and just something. Now, a lot of things happened before that. So when I was like, I guess, 14, I had a paper route. So I'd get up in the morning and I'd go put my papers in my thing, deliver a few, go to Terrace Park in Albany and smoke a joint, and then finish delivering my paper route, and then go to school, and I'd be on the steps at Berkeley High School. And on the steps at Berkeley High School, you could get, for a dollar, you could get two joints of Colombian Brown, something like that, one incredibly small joint of green marijuana, or a hit of LSD, which is extremely cost-effective. So as you can imagine, I didn't last very long in school. I dropped out immediately upon that being an option. But I hadn't really gone to class for a year before that. And then I would go to my younger brothers, both of whom were in the program. Holy shit, I can't even keep track anymore. To their paper route money, and I would steal their checks for $6.25, and I would put them in my bill, and I would take my cash, and I would buy tie stick with it, which was a thing they used to have in those days, kind of marijuana that you could get that was wrapped around a bamboo stick that came from presumably Thailand. That was a pretty powerful pot for the day. And then I would sell some of it and smoke the rest of it. And this is when I was 14. Now, I have a really shitty memory for exactly how all this went down for some reason. But I do remember drinking. You know, I remember Roy Koenig lived up on the corner, and he was like a hillbilly from Kentucky, where the fuck he was from. And he'd been in the Marines, and he was a cool guy. He was a very cool guy, but he was a reliable source of alcohol. And I had another hillbilly friend up around the corner who was my age, Roy, and we'd go over there and get drunk with Roy, with other Roy. Jesus Christ, they're both named Roy. I never thought about that before. But anyway, the point is that we would get drunk. And I remember walking up the street one time, and we'd been drinking some whatever it is in those tall brown bottles that they had in those days, Schlitz. Maybe I can remember what the fuck that was. But I remember just walking up the street and just kind of throwing up over my shoulder, you know, one continuous long stream, wiping my mouth, not slowing down, not missing a step. And so obviously I had already been drinking it for some time. I certainly was not 15 at that point. And then, let's see, then when I was 16, I met a girl. Oh my God. So she ran away from home, so I ran away from home. And then she came to live at my house with my mom and my siblings, and then we had just an enormous amount of sex, as you can imagine, because I was 16 years old. And I remember, and she was just fucking trouble. Oh my God, was she ever trouble. She was, you know, just this, a T like this high, you know, trouble. And and it was great, you know. Anyway, I remember we went somewhere and I stole a shot glass from wherever the fuck I stole this little shot glass, and my friend brought over a bottle of gin. I was 16 at this point, and I was going to drink from my shot glass, so I did 7 shots from this fucking shot glass, and I threw the fucking thing away and started drinking from the bottle. And as far as I know, that was the only time I ever drank from a glass that I wasn't in a bar. I never drank from the glass. I always drank from the bottle like a normal fucking human being. And but I remember that, just thinking to myself, this is fucking unbelievably stupid, this little tiny glass, you know? And I had a very high tolerance for alcohol long after other people were like, you know, like all of you, like you know what I mean. It'd be like, you'd start drinking at like 7 because you were going to start drinking at 9, right? So then you start drinking at 9, and then around 1 or so in the morning, you're starting to come down, and it's just the worst fucking feeling in the world, you know what I mean? It's just like, it's just horrible, you know? And I was really emotionally fucked up. I mean, I was seriously emotionally fucked up. Whenever I thought about the future, it just made me sick with dread and horror. And I mean like tomorrow, whenever I thought about the future, I just felt sick with dread. I just fucking stopped doing it. I was already living one day at a time. So it wasn't until much later that I learned to have hope, fucking 6 years ago. So anyway, I've been in a lot of therapy of late. But anyway, so the point is that was when I was 16. Anyway, so then she fucked all my friends, and that was the end of that. And then, so I moved in with another girl when I was 17. And she lived in a kind of a commune over in Ashby, up above college, called the Frog House. And it was the best fucking thing that ever happened to me, because I learned something about love there. You know what I mean? It was actually a functional hippie commune. And until then, you know, I was a little edgy on account of my childhood. Some people might say insane. When I got sober, I was flat out delusional for a couple of years. I would have these delusions. I would think these things. I believed them to be true. I mean, I knew they were fucking true. Some conspiracy or other that you had hatched up about me. And I'd have to go to my sponsor and say, this is what I think is happening. And he'd be like, no, man. No, that's not happening. And I sort of knew they were delusions, you know what I mean? I kind of knew that was the case. It didn't happen eight times or something like that, to the point where I actually literally thought to myself, I don't know for a fact that I'm not insane, right? I was really emotionally fucked up. Anyway, that's the point. And so I didn't have any vested interest in being sober. There was nothing there for me. You know what I mean? It wasn't a state of mind that I associated with pleasure in any way, shape, or form. So I just wanted to be high until I saw, you know, certain things. So anyway, what I did when I lived there is I spent an enormous amount of time on Durant and Telegraph when I was 17, 18, 19, 20, really until I got sober, to 21, an enormous amount of time. There's a postcard somewhere, and it's got a picture of Rob Noxious. None of you ever heard of him. And a picture of Christy, who's in the program, and a picture of somebody else. And then there's this super tall, skinny guy. He used to be hella skinny. I'm on a diet right now. Anyway, super skinny with bushy hair coming out from underneath the headband out to about here, right? And that was a picture of me. I was in that picture, that little postcard of Telegraph, because I was there all the fucking time because I worked there. I worked at Top Dog on Northside with Dave Swain. None of you remember. Order. He was there for a long time. He died eventually from alcoholism. He got up to go to work and had a heart attack, trying to live on hot dogs and beer. I drank with that motherfucker a lot. Oh, my fucking God. We drank every Friday and Saturday night. We drank like, I don't know, whatever. It was 2 6-packs of beer. And then in the back were these bottles of whiskey that you just never saw before again or whatever. You know, it's like this old crow. This would be like old muskrat or some shit like that. I don't know where these bottles of whiskey came from, but they were horrible. And they were like, the whiskey was horrible, you know? But we drank them anyway, of course. We drank them a lot. Spent some time in the office back there because the shifts were over at 2 a.m., right? So we'd hang out there drinking, me and Dave and Tim, other people that I worked there with. And so that all happened. And then on Durant and Telegraph, you know, you can see the whole spectrum of alcoholism. There was us, me and my cronies. I had a series of cronies. I had about, you know, a dozen friends or so that I ran with, some of whom were in the program, some of them who were not alcoholics. One of them, Sam, he just fucking stopped drinking because he had high blood sugar. The fucker drank like a fucking maintenance alcoholic his whole life. And then the doctor, you have high blood sugar. So he stopped, and all this weird puffiness went out of his face, and he lost 20 pounds. It's like, what the fuck, you son of a bitch. All that time, you could stop, right? Just bizarre to me, you know. Anyway, so that happened. I remember hanging out with Peter, who's in the program now, or I hope he is, and I would go over there with him and Dave, and both of them alcoholics, and then we would play. I would play speed chess and drink a Rainier Ale with Dave, and then he would cook something in the middle of the night and we'd eat it. This is incredibly badass to me. I can't even tell you how wonderful these times were. And then we'd get up in the morning and there'd be cold coffee and flat Rainier and just pour one into the other, okay. Knock it back, right? Mm-hmm. And he taught me that trick. And so that was okay. Now I'm into like 19, somewhere in there, and I'm starting to think about trying to control it, and it's not going really well. Oh, I said, you could see the whole progression. You could see us, and then you could see the guys who are a little bit more fucked up, which is to say they were homeless. But they were still somewhat healthy. Like, they were, like, maybe 32 years old. There was a number of these guys on Durant and Telegraph, about 32 years old, that were just living on Durant and Telegraph, who were clearly fucking alcoholics. I mean, you could tell. I mean, it was just common knowledge if you grew up on that street. And then you could see the guy that I like to talk about, who I saw one day. I ate a tremendous amount of LSD, so I had a whole... I would eat it, and then in the morning I'd eat more to stay awake. So I took it like people take meth, kind of, to stay up a couple days. And so it was in one of those interludes, you know, and it was all very psychedelic. And I was down by what used to be Shakespeare Books, and there was a guy there on the curb, and I was checking him out for a little while, you know, for some timeless period, staring at him. And his pants were half across his butt, and he'd had diarrhea, and it had dried. And he wasn't that fucking old. You know what I mean? He was not an old man, but he might as well have been 110. You know what I mean? He was probably like 47 or something. And he was trying to get warm between the concrete sidewalk and the side of Shakespeare Books by jamming himself into that little crevice there. When I eventually did get sober, I realized, oh my God, that's fucking me. That was my first step, really. More than any other single thing when I got sober, that was my first step. That is fucking me. It's going to happen on Telegraph Avenue, the whole fucking scene of my alcohols. It's going to happen on those six blocks, and I'm going to wind up being that guy. And that was extremely depressing for me. That was very, very distressing because, I'm just skipping ahead a little bit now, because I was a total fucking incompetent. I couldn't do anything. I literally was the kind of person, if you sent me to the drugstore for a pack of Pall Mall, I'd come back with Winston. This literally happened. Walking to the drugstore, I forgot I brought back Winston instead of Pall Mall. And that's just the way that I was with every fucking thing, you know. So they told me in the beginning, 1 in 17 gets a year. I think the statistics are slightly better now. But at that time, it was 1 in 17 gets a year. And I thought, shit, I'm not 1 in one half. You know, if it can be fucked up, I'll fuck it up. So as soon as I realized I was an alcoholic, I realized that is me. And it made me feel horrible. I felt really, really bad. And that turned out to be my first step. That bad feeling, which lasted about 6 fucking weeks, you know, around 1744 University, which is where I was, that was the Berkeley Fellowship at that time. Just feeling fucking horrible. But then it turned out, by God, here I am, 36 years later, and I never had a drink. So it turned out that was a damn good thing I did that. So anyway, let's go back. I'm trying to just share my drunkalogue a little bit. I don't personally like people that don't have a drunkalogue because I just sort of figure that I'm just going to skip over my drunkalogue and think, oh, you're not an alcoholic. That's what personally what I think. If you don't have a drunkalogue, you're not a fucking alcoholic. You didn't qualify, you're not qualified. Why am I even sitting here? I might be I might be a little old school about that. So anyway, so what happened then is all I know is I was drunk all the fucking time. I was drunk all the time. I was just drunk. I stopped smoking pot because it made me paranoid. I stopped taking LSD because I had a revelation on LSD. You gotta stop taking LSD. So I was just drinking, and I had a little fucked up. I got fired from 7 dishwashing, sandwich making jobs, one after the other. But I always had a little bit of money because I was incompetent. You know what I mean? They fired me for good reason, and so I had enough money to buy whatever. You know, I was a half pint of 10 high was $1.76. So there you go. You can get drunk, you know, on a half pint of 10 high. And point is that my dad got sober when I was 17. Now, his story was he had stopped eating. And in case you don't know, that's how you die in alcoholism. You stop eating because you can get all your calories from alcohol. It happened to my friend Jan Hendrick not too long ago. He stopped eating and he bled to death from his nose. He had a nosebleed and he died from it because he didn't have enough minerals and vitamins or whatever to build cell walls in his veins anymore, right? That was just about a couple years ago. And I haven't really completely gotten over that. Anyway, so he was a guy, we were very tight, very, very tight for a pretty long time. But anyway, so he got sober. So one day, this is the ultimate part that's always in my story, however I tell it, I was living at my mom's house again. I was 21 years old, and I had made a fool of myself at a work party. And I wasn't sure exactly how I'd made a fool of myself, but my boss had started yelling at me all of a sudden. He was a man I had a lot of respect for. It had a really profound positive effect on me, actually, as it turned out. And so I thought, I got to put together 3 months, 90 days of sobriety. I'm just going to not drink for 3 months. Like, anybody can do that. Fuck, I can definitely do that. I did that on January 1st because it was a New Year's Eve party. Drinking sake. And so Hideo Sawa, he was Japanese, so it was a Japanese party. So then anyway, what happened? I was sitting on the corner of, on the 26th, I think, of January, of Curtis and Solano in Albany, and there used to be a Michael's Liquor Store. I was waiting for the bus, and I thought to myself, if the bus takes very long to come, I'm going to go into Michael's Liquors and buy that very half pint of 10 high whiskey. But if the bus comes very quickly, I won't. You know what I mean? And I just had to recognize the simple truth of that. And I was sitting there, I was thinking, all this time I'd been putting the brakes on my drinking and using. I'd been putting the brakes on, and the brakes had just worn through. There were no more brakes. I didn't have any brakes left at all. I mean, there was just nothing. I had no ability to stop. I wasn't going to be able to stop for 90 days. It was really obvious because the 26th day, I was kind of proud I got 26 days, by the way. But I really wasn't going to make it more than another couple days, right? And so I thought, that's pretty bad. So I called up my dad because he was the only thing remotely like an authority figure that I had. And I mean, boy howdy, was he the only thing remotely like an authority figure that I had. And I said to him, you know, I can't control my drinking. And this dude was in AA, right? It was pretty clear what he was going to say. But I didn't know he was going to say that because I hadn't put together the fact that he was in AA with what was happening to me mentally, which was probably denial. And he said, well, I've had my eye on you for a while. Maybe you should come to an AA meeting. And so I said, what a remarkable idea, you know? You think? I guess I should try that. It sounds like as I'm checking down my list of things to try, I should definitely check that off the list. And so I went to 1744. Now at that time, AA was much smaller than it is now. It got really big, and then it kind of shrank again. It's still much larger than it was. There was only like in Berkeley AA, there was only like 45 people. I just made that shit up. And but it was the same people over and over and over again, so you could easily get to know them all, right? And so I got to know them all, right? And some of them are still around, you know. Some few of those guys, Mr. Bill is still around and whatnot. And Bill has a year more than I do, so he was there. And anyway, a number of people, whose names I could drop, but that wouldn't make any sense because we don't have last names, right? So anyway, the point is that I went to the meeting, and right away I knew I was an alcoholic because until then I'd been terminally unique, right? I've been unique, and everybody in the room was like me. Every fucking single person in the room was like me. They were all unique, like me, in the exact same way, and they were all alcoholic. And that's like 2 + 2 = 4. I was capable of that. If they're just like me and they're all alcoholic and nobody else is like me, then I'm an alcoholic. So then I thought to myself, then I had the normal struggle that everybody has with the first step, which is, well, I don't fucking want to be an alcoholic. I don't want to be mentally and emotionally different than my fellows. I don't want that because it feels bad, and also I won't be able to drink anymore. And so my thinking was, it just was inevitable, you know, because it was the key that made sense of my whole life. If I was alcoholic, every single goddamn inexplicable thing about my life made sense. You know what I mean? That just didn't make any sense. It solved every fucking problem that had confused me. You know what I mean? And so I went, okay, I'm a fucking alcoholic, and I made the jump of doing my first step. Now I'm going to go through the steps. This is the experience, strength, and hope part of it. Kind of starting right in here a little bit, and I'll probably talk about how it is now a little bit. And so I had to work the second step, right? So I got a sponsor, and my sponsor was actually a guy in the Jesuit seminary. I had two Jesuit sponsors, and the other guy I picked just because he laughed in meetings. He just laughed and laughed and laughed, Mark. What's bizarre is all three of those guys are still sober. One of them's in Canada, one of them is Father Tom, and one of them is down in Virginia. So anyway, I see him from time to time. I don't actually run with a sponsor. I don't really run with a sponsor in any big way since I had about 12 years sober. But I have a friend of mine. He knows every fucking little cranny of my soul. And I know every cranny of his soul. You know what I mean? And I don't really do anything without talking to him. And he has, I don't know what he's got now. He's got 18 years or something. He drank for a while. And anyway, the point being is that I had to come to believe in a power greater than myself. You know what I mean? And because it was very clear I was insane. I mean, that was, as soon as I got sober, it was super fucking clear that I was insane. I mean, there was no doubt about that. And so I had an advantage, which is that I had seen God on LSD. And when I saw God on LSD, I thought, then this is my father's training, right? This is something my dad would have said. It was verbatim. That's the motherfucker who's responsible for all this. Right? That's what I thought. So what I had to overcome to get to work a second step and to work a third step was anger. I was pissed off. I was one of those guys. People said to me when I was 10 years sober, oh my God, you were so angry when you came in. You know? And I am, you know, I guess pathetic asshole was my attitude towards other people. You pathetic fucking asshole. So I guess perhaps I was angry. So that's all worn off now. I never get angry now. And except in traffic. And at my dog sometimes. Point is that, or if someone repeats the same thing to me 3 times, all those things will do it. But anyway, point is that I'm not hardly a spiritual paragon. That's the point. So anyway, I worked the step, and then I worked a really, really, really incredibly shitty 4-step. It was like a fucking joke. And I worked that 4-step, and it wasn't even really shaped like a 4-step. It was so lame. And then I did a 5th step with my sponsor, who said, oh, that's very nice. And I said, that's why I picked it. He was a gay Jesuit minister. Priest. I knew he wouldn't hurt me. That's why I chose him. So anyway, then I went on and started thinking about my defects of character. I began to ponder the question of my defects of character. And what had emerged in my, even though my 5th step wasn't very good, what had emerged is that my primary character defects were arrogance and hatred. which I recommend to everyone, by the way, is character defects. If you're going to have core character defects, I recommend those too, because they'll get you through a lot of different kinds of trouble. And so I went ahead and began to try to work on those things. And self-pity and entitlement, you know, and of course, naturally, fear. I had so much fear, though, that I didn't really try to deal with that for years. I just lived in a sea of fear all the time and thought nothing of it. That wasn't unusual for me at all. And so as time went on, I learned honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And I learned gratitude. And these are the spiritual principles that I think are central to AA, without which nothing. Without honesty, you just don't have the faintest fucking hope of ever being spiritual, because you are always working with a lie. The whole time you'll just be working with a lie. By this I mean self-honesty. And then open-mindedness is essentially important because of God, because you have to be able to turn your life and will over to the care of God. And that's just, Jesus God fucking Christ, how do you turn your life and will over to God? I mean, there's just no specific instructions for that. You don't ever even know what the fuck that means, right? So you just have to be constantly open-minded, you know? Like, okay, I don't know, what next? Right? Open-minded, right? And then willing, you got to be fucking willing. And because otherwise, if you won't work this, you won't do any work. And if you don't do some work, you can't get sober. You got to do a little bit of work. You got to be slightly introverted. You got to look within a little bit. You got to deal with your pain. You know what I mean? You've got to think about how you're affecting other people and try to be of service in whatever small way that you can be, because that's basically the rules of AA. And then the other two things that I want to talk about in terms of spirituality, this is the experience, strength, and hope part, remember. I'm doing my best here. This is humility and gratitude. And the opposite of humility, of course, is arrogance. And, you know, I love me some arrogance, you know what I mean? And from an arrogant point of view, you know, you are all my inferiors, right? And that's my secret knowledge, right, that I have, right? And then, of course, you know, there's no factual basis for that, but it kind of like makes me feel slightly less insecure, which is like this deep-seated insecurity that I'm trying to fight all the time, right? Well, that's one thing, but then there's a whole nother level below that, which is the level of humility, which, again, is simply being humble enough to accept a fucking higher power. And that's the ultimate bar below which I personally have to pass. There's a bar of humility that I have to have, and it has to be enough to get under that fucking bar to accept that there's a power greater than myself. Getting close here. One more thing, and then I'll just say some other shit and I'll shut up. So the other thing is gratitude. Now, gratitude is fucking amazing. Gratitude, I'm not going to say anything about forgiveness, but forgiveness is amazing too. But gratitude is really amazing. And gratitude is amazing because it's the opposite of resentment. It's the fucking Bill Kay, it's what Bill Kay, Big Book Bill, used to say, and it was just fantastic. He'd say, gratitude is the opposite of resentment, and you cannot have both of them at once. They said they are incompatible. And for a guy like me, that's very nice. That's very, very nice, because resentment for me is like it's like a live rat trying to tear itself out from within, basically. It's just really unpleasant. And real resentment for me is full time. I haven't done it very often, but it's basically like, you motherfucker said what? That motherfucker said what? He thinks I'm what? What does that motherfucker think I am? What does he fucking think I am? What the fuck does he fucking, that motherfucker? Right? And it does not fucking stop. That can go on for 16 fucking hours, just like that. Right? So, I mean, I don't have resentments. I just fucking, I can't fuck with that shit. It's like radioactive waste for me. And point is that gratitude is the absolute thing. And the opposite of gratitude is entitlement. Entitlement is just the crushing end of all gratitude. It means I deserve this. I'm not grateful for this Pepsi, Coke, sorry. This Coke is mine, and I deserve it. You know what I mean? Or whatever. This girlfriend is mine, and I deserve it. You know, this whatever. I deserve more than what I have, right? That's it. There's no gratitude. And then I'm prey to resentment, right? So I've got that. So what it's like, fuck, I'm not going to get to what it's like now. What it's like now is, I'll tell you real briefly, I broke both my legs. I fell off the roof, basically, because I asked my mom to move in with me to help out with the rent, and she had fucking dementia, turned out later, much later. And so she did a whole series of erratic things, which, some of which was acting out some of her childhood trauma, shall we say. And it was really threw me for a loop. And I just said, some of that stuff I just said, this is what I said. And this is why I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to the grave with this. I'm not telling anybody that that fucking happened. I'm going to the grave with this. And then like a week later, I stepped off the roof completely unnecessarily. You know what I mean? I was lying there on the ground with my legs broken and all my safety, I'm a building contractor, all my safety information lit up in red in my mind, all the things that I'd done wrong, you know? And I broke my legs. Now, according to my dad, when I broke my legs, I was helpless, right? It's time for the vultures to come in, right? The vultures come in now, right? I'm helpless. Nope. People from the program especially, but other people too from my past, came to my house every fucking night for, what, 6 weeks or something? And they brought food. They visited me. They signed up on the telephone. And the schedule was packed. Someone came. Eric built my roof for a relative pittance because it was, that's why I fell off the roof. I was trying to do my roof, and I was gonna, rain was just gonna come straight the fuck in, right? And so you know, people just really, 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 really stepped up, you know. And it really, I've spent in therapy, I should say, for 12 years now, for just because. but it really had a fundamental impact on me and changed the way that I am able to trust other people. Which wasn't very good. It's about 1 minute, so we're getting there. Yeah. So anyway, let's see if I have any final closing words here. I'll say one more thing, and I say this from time to time. I'm sort of very faintly famous for saying this. In my time in AA, there was one entire group of people, and they all fucking drank. They disappeared. And then there was a whole other entire group of people. They all fucking drank. That happened several times. Right now I'm on a group of people now that I saw them all come in. A lot of them have got about 7 years. Robert lasted through about 3 of those, I should say. So the point is that our seats in here are not fucking secure. You know what I mean? And that's something that I have been able to see over a long fucking time. It's really easy to take this stuff for granted and treat it like a sort of an exclusive club that we're in. But at the core of it is some very serious business, you know, and it's really good to look sharp, you know, and maintain your spiritual condition in the eyes of God, you know, and to really think like that from time to time. And that's all I have. Thank you.